The ocean. It covers more than 70% of the planet's surface. It drives our weather, regulates temperature. It's home to countless species. Yet we know more about the surface of the moon than we do the ocean floor. Today we're going to hear from oceanographer Tim Battista, a NOAA scientist who is working to change that. Tim is going to dial us in on one important part of the ocean, the Caribbean. In late April and early March of 2015, he's co-leading a week-long expedition on the NOAA ship Nancy Foster to map out parts of a vast, sprawling coral reef ecosystem around the U.S. Virgin Islands. It's an undersea realm that we know surprisingly little about. Tim, welcome to the podcast. So this is your team's 12th consecutive year of creating intricate three-dimensional maps in this region that show what lies beneath the waves. So let's start there. Why the Caribbean?
There are fundamental data gaps in the U.S. Caribbean, and the U.S. Caribbean being one of the important coral reef ecosystems in the U.S. And so fundamentally, we are conducting this mission to help fill those data and informational gaps and provide products to help researchers and resource managers be able to better perform their jobs, whether it's science or decision making.
So could you talk about what you mean when you say fundamental data gaps? What kind of gaps are you trying to fill?
So what the NOAA ship presents is really a state-of-the-art capability to collect data both on the types and distribution of the bottom habitats, so the seafloor coral reef ecosystem, as well as the distribution of fish throughout that space. So we're simultaneously collecting both the underlying habitats and the fish as they're associated with those habitats and seeing what's down there and seeing the shape of the seafloor and seeing the composition of the seafloor and seeing things that no one has really ever connected together. I think this is really intriguing to me. In some cases, that reveals shipwrecks, other types of objects. We see a lot of military objects, you know, from previous days, but mostly, you know, just the uniqueness of the coral reef ecosystem.
And these underwater landscapes that you're mapping, these are places that we don't know much or anything about, right?
So much of the ocean has not been mapped. And even those areas that have been mapped, the data density is so sparse that you have a hard time really understanding what's down there. In many cases, the places we go have not been visited for 20, 40, 50, or more years. To give you an example, last year we were mapping over portions of Lang Bank on the east side of St. Croix. And some of those areas had not been surveyed since the early 1900s. And those were being done by what we would consider to be antiquated technologies. So, you know, a ship would go out and they would deploy what was called a lead line, which is essentially a string with a lead weight on the end of it to measure the depth. And pretty good to give you a general representation was there, but you know, they're maybe collecting 100, 200 points a day. So they're missing a lot, right? You have a series of points and a lot of gaps between those points. 200 points a day on a good day, let's say back then, and we're collecting 1,500 points per day currently with our current capabilities. So I find that to be fascinating, that we're able to provide a level of detail that has never been seen before.
What kind of tech are you using to get this level of detail?
So the NOAA ship has a variety of different acoustic sonars on board, and they serve different functions. And this is one of the amazing capabilities of the NOAA ship, Nancy Foster, is its breadth of capability. So the ship has two distinct multi-beam sonars, which in total represents three different frequencies of sound. And those frequencies allow us to map the seafloor at different depths. And typically, the higher the frequency of the sonar, the greater the data density, but higher frequencies are less able to penetrate deeper in the water. So if you're mapping shallow waters, you want a higher frequency. If you're mapping deeper waters, you want a lower frequency. And the NOAA ship has, as I mentioned, three frequencies. And so essentially we're able to map from about 5 meters water depth to 1,500 meters water depth, quite a range. And what those sonars do is they project sound. And a multibeam is a what they call a swath system. So it is projecting sound in sort of a fan-like presentation from underneath the ship. And that fan represents a collection of about 300 individual beams of sound. So those beams of sound are broadcasted out from the bottom of the ship, and then it's listening for their return. And as the sound propagates, eventually it hits the seafloor and bounces back up. And through physics, we know that sound travels at relatively the same speed. And so if we calculate the time from when it was broadcast to when it returned, you divide it by two and you know the speed of sound, then you can figure out the depth. Sound speed does vary, and so we have to correct for that. So if we can think of that sound broadcasting out, each ping is broadcast out about 5 times a second. And we have approximately 300 beams of sound. So 300 times 5 is about 1,500 soundings per second. And that density of data is what allows us to literally paint the seafloor. So we are painting the seafloor with sound, and that information tells us the topography, is a fancy word for the shape of the seafloor. So is that seafloor flat? Is that seafloor have ridges? Is that seafloor a shelf that's going from shallow to deep? Are there nooks and crannies? These are all properties that we want to know about.
I like that image. You paint the seafloor with sound to generate a picture of what it looks like. Can multi-beam sonar tell us anything else beyond the seafloor's shape?
The other aspect that comes from a multi-beam sonar, in addition to bathymetry and topography, is what's known as backscatter. And backscatter is a term which describes the intensity of sound that is reflected from the seafloor. So I like to give an analogy when I'm talking to kids about singing in the shower. So when we sing in the shower, right, our voice sounds really good. You have a tile surrounding the shower, right? The sound is being broadcasted from your mouth and reflects off that hard tile, and most of it comes back to our ears, and it sounds really strong and bright. And that's analogous to a hard bottom feature on the seafloor. So if you had a hard coral reef, a lot of the sound being broadcast from the ship is going to bounce back and be received. The other example is, of course, if we're singing in the closet. You have all those clothes hanging in the closet, right? Your sound is being absorbed by those clothes. They're absorbent material. Not all the sound is being returned to your ears. And it's the same principle with the seafloor. There are certain types of features that absorb sound, such as mud. And so we are able to look at the data from a sonar, and using that principle that I just described, sound intensity, actually map out the differences in bottom habitat based on how much sound is being returned from the signal. So the combination of topography and the backscatter intensity allows us to create very detailed three-dimensional maps of the bottom. And we can bring that data into a 3D visualizer and drape the sound intensity over top of a model of the seafloor and look at it from all different angles to see how the bottom changes over distances and what types of habitats are on top of those of that seafloor.
That is really cool. So multi-beam sonar is how you map the seafloor. But I understand that you're using a different kind of sonar called a fish acoustic sonar to figure out exactly where populations of fish are located. So how does that work?
These are scientific-grade sonar systems which measure things in the water column. So anything off the bottom and up to the ship. And that can include small things like food or diatoms in the water. Could be marine mammals, turtles. But mostly we're focused on fish, and it's a very good way of detecting fish in the water. And what's different than fish sonars you may have in your recreational fishing boat is that these sonars are able to accurately measure the length of a fish that it detects and also very accurately capture where it is in space. So not only horizontally in space, but also vertically in space. Not all fish are distributed at the bottom. Some may be higher in the water column, mid-column, or some may be near the surface. And both of these sonars can work together. So we're running them at the same time. So not only are we mapping the seafloor itself and the habitats, we're mapping the fish as they are distributed above that seafloor. And we can start to make linkages on what types of fish are distributed over certain habitats, what size of fish are distributed over certain habitats. Are they distributed differently day versus night? Are they using different spaces at different times of the day? Are there aggregations present? If we find a high density of fish, a ball of fish, if you will, at certain locations, well, that suggests an aggregation. And these are all important things to bring together.
So you use the ship's multi-beam sonar and fish acoustic sonar for mapping out basically the water column from surface to seafloor. But you will also be bringing along a ROV, a remotely operated vehicle, with a high-def camera. And you'll have what are known as ocean gliders to record underwater sounds. I'd like to talk about how you'll be using these tools. So let's start with the ROV.
We have the remotely operated vehicle, which can go down and provide us the eyeballs underneath the water to see what is the health of the ecosystem. You know, are we dealing with live or dead coral, or helping us to understand what the sonars are capturing from the data that they're collecting. The ROV allows us to take the data coming from the multi-beam sonars and interpret its meaning, because that data may not be readily transferable to the human mind what it is. We know it's different. The signal may tell us what's different, but by putting the ROV down, we can actually get eyes on the bottom to see, that signal coming from the sonar was mud, or that signal was a coral reef habitat.
And the ocean gliders?
So these are torpedo-shaped vehicles, which are autonomous, which means they act on their own. We program them to where they should be going. They go off on their mission, collecting data without us having to interact with them at all. And then they report out their findings. So that provides another capability without us even having to monitor them.
So about the gliders, I want to ask you about one method that you'll be testing out to help you locate places where fish aggregate in this part of the Caribbean. If I understand this correctly, some species of fish gather to spawn in the spring, timed with the lunar cycle, and you'll be using the gliders to help you locate those spots.
Well, some fish aggregate, and many of those that we're interested in are the fish that are economically and ecologically important. So, for example, snappers and groupers, you know, the ones that fishermen catch and we like to eat. Typically around the full moon, fish aggregate. They come from miles away, sometimes quite far, you know, hundreds of miles, to generally one location, and they aggregate together. But it's basically synchronized spawning, so it's a reproductive strategy. So one of the interesting things during the aggregation, some species actually vocalize. For instance, some of the grouper species actually have a vocalization pattern, a grunting, if you will, and that's considered part of their courtship behavior. One of the things that we're exploring with the use of the gliders is being able to detect that vocalization. And there are other researchers who are also looking at this. They put down hydrophones on the seafloor to listen for those vocalizations. Again, these aggregations are occurring generally in certain spots. If you put the hydrophone in the right spot, you might hear those fish eliciting that sound behavior. With the use of the glider, we're mounting a hydrophone on it, so it's listening, and the glider is swimming through the ocean, listening for those vocalizations. And our idea is we can't be everywhere at the same time, but the glider can maneuver itself along the shelf edge of the seafloor and listen for those fish. And that could provide a very robust way for us to detect where aggregations are occurring that we weren't already aware of.
All right, so let's put it all together. From the gliders to the ROV to sonar, there's a lot of different tools at play here. I gotta ask, why can't you just use the ship's sonar systems to create a map and call it a day?
In doing science, we need to look at the environment at multiple spatial scales. The fine scale, so something as, you know, as close as being able to see the nodules on a coral or the blades on a seagrass. And then looking out a little broader than that, we need to see how those features are in the context of the features around them. And then beyond that, the broad scale. So how do those smaller things fit into the context of a much bigger picture, say on the scale of a geologic feature, a promontory or a ledge or something like that. So looking at all three scales, not simultaneously, but together, helps us get a better picture of the landscape. And because all those factors are important in understanding perhaps where fish are going, why they're going there, and how many are going there, as well as the distribution and health of the coral reef ecosystem.
You'll be collecting a lot of information. How much time do you have to gather all this data during one of these yearly expeditions? Could you tell us what a typical work day is like?
This year in 2015, we have 8 science days aboard the NOAA ship Nancy Foster. And our time on the ship, of course, is short, but the ship operates 24 hours a day. So we have time to conduct science both night and day. A typical workday is comprised of basically 3 components. We break them up into 8-hour shifts. So during the daytime, we're conducting remotely operated vehicle transects. We deploy the vehicle in the water. It's imaging the bottom, taking pictures and exploring the transects. So those are lines along the seafloor. And then we transition into evening operations, which focus on collecting acoustic information. And so literally the ship is driving lines, mowing the lawn, we call it, back and forth across the seafloor, and they're imaging the bottom with acoustic sonars. And that continues throughout the night. And then in the morning we wake up and basically do it all over again.
I wanted to hit on this because it's still not quite clear to me. Who is all this data for? Can you tell us how exactly it's going to be used?
So this project is considered what is called an Integrated Ocean and Coastal Mapping Project, IOCM for short. And what that entails, or the objective of IOCM, is to collect once, use many times. So that means that we are collecting data that could be used to serve a variety of needs simultaneously. One of those needs is for the Coral Reef Conservation Program, of which I am being funded by, and they're charged to conserve and manage coral reef ecosystems. One of the others is NOAA's Office of Coastal Survey, who are charged with producing navigational charts for safe navigation. So we collect data to a standard that can be included in updates to nautical charts. So the other area, so we collect information on the distribution and abundance of fish with the fishery sonars. We are now collaborating with NOAA's Fishery Service to try and make possible means that they can utilize that data as part of their management measures, the federal management measures for conserving and managing fish populations. So that is still a work in progress, but we're collecting a lot of data that can help complement their studies. Additionally, there are the resource management agencies other than NOAA's Coral Reef Conservation Program who are charged with making decisions about the protection or limits or other measures for the areas that they're responsible for. So this would be the U.S. Virgin Islands territorial government. And so that data is very valuable to them for providing a time series of the condition of the ecosystem at that location.
All right, we have time for one more question. So you just said that this data provides a time series of the condition of this coral reef ecosystem, and that helps people basically understand what's going on beneath the waves. Now in the U.S. Virgin Islands, of course, the ocean is a huge part of the livelihood of most people. I wondered if you could tell us some of the kinds of insights that people might get from these visualizations that you're providing of the seafloor and the habitats underneath the ocean?
So in the case of the U.S. Caribbean, there are a number of known human stressors on that in that region, whether it's development, nutrient runoff, sediment runoff, putting in fiber optic cables or other cable laying activities, fishing pressure. So these are stressors that they are wrestling with how to balance their economic needs with conserving the ecological needs. And so our activities fall and support, we hope, many of the decisions that they need to make regarding place-based conservation. So this information, we think, will readily support a resource manager or a decision maker in determining how to best conserve and utilize and balance those conflicting uses.
That was NOAA oceanographer Tim Battista with NOS's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science. Head to oceanservice.noaa.gov for more about this expedition. And thanks for listening to Making Waves from NOAA's National Ocean Service.